Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy at the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
In the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writers series. And we're picking up with our reading of St. Isaac the Syrian, his ascetical homilies. And we're starting a new homily this evening, homily 26, beginning on page 252 of the text. And if you've read ahead at all, you probably have noticed that this is a little bit more of a complicated homily. Almost at times it seems very difficult to call it a homily because it seems to be more of a discourse on the order of creation itself, and in particular the various order of angels, and in that sense it almost seems like a scholastic text. But with Isaac, everything has this practical purpose. You know, His purpose isn't to be purely speculative here about the order of creation itself and to discuss angels for the sake simply of discussing them, but it's because they see, and he sees so clearly how intimately linked we are with the angels in regards to our gaining access to revelation, that they are actually given to us to guide us into deeper and deeper truth, that there is an intimate relationship, in other words, that we have with the angels. And the greater our purity of heart becomes, the more that we are able to perceive their presence, but also the truth that they are given to reveal to us. And the greater capacity we also have to see the demons as well. And so he spells all of these things out for us in this homily, the next, and then the third after that, to make very concrete for us the world in which we exist and the concrete presence of angels within our spiritual life and how essential they are. Often, I think, for us as Catholics, we believe in angels. We have this sense of their presence, but not in the concrete and tangible way with which Isaac speaks of them in these next homilies. And if you have that handout handy that I gave you from the book St. Isaac the Syrian and His Spiritual Legacy by Metropolitan Hilarion, I just want you to take a look at one. The chapter is magnificent, I think, in terms of laying out for us Isaac's angelology, but if you take a look at one paragraph on page 110, the bottom, angelic mysticism, and I just want to read the first paragraph, which I think will give us a sense of where Isaac is taking us, and then we're just going to go to the text itself and allow him to set things out. The author writes, "The most important function of angels in relation to humans, according to Isaac, is to provide inner inspiration and illumination. This is deeply connected with the idea of celestial hierarchy, which in turn is not detached from human beings." And so Isaac, within the text, he immediately jumps in to speak to us about the order of angels and where we stand in relationship to them and also demons. Namely, human beings and angels ultimately constitute one hierarchy, that of rational, created beings, in which humans have angels as guides and teachers. Indeed, one of the most interesting remarks in Isaac's writings is that human nature cannot have inner growth or illumination without the guidance given by angels. This is due to the hierarchical character of creation. Illumination does not come by itself impersonally, but through intercession. Therefore, the main function of angels in relation to man consists of existential guidance, spiritual illumination, and teaching in order to achieve inner growth. And so, in the spiritual life, are being drawn into the deeper truths of God himself. He's revealed to us, but also of his inner life, that this isn't given to us in an impersonal way, that within creation itself there's this radical intimacy that exists, and things have been created in such a way that the angels, because of their more direct contemplation of these realities, given their rank within the angels, can guide us, illuminate us in our pursuit of greater holiness and of contemplation. And so again, they're not abstract characters for us in the spiritual life, distant, but rather very personal. And the deeper our purity of heart becomes, the more the nous is purified and gains a greater clarity of vision, the more clearly we see the truth that they teach and reveal to us, and also the greater our perception of them becomes, as well as demons in terms of their influence in trying to pull us away from the path of truth. And so I think this is very important for us to understand. This isn't just an intellectual exercise, in other words, for Isaac. He's speaking to something directly and very important for our spiritual life and growth, that we seek that purity of heart. We enter into our prayer deeply with this radical openness to those God has given to us to guide us in the spiritual life. They become our spiritual guides in the way of truth. Any comments about that before we leap into the text? And you can refer to the chapter if you'd like at any point, if you had a chance to read through it. Otherwise, we'll just make our way slowly through this. Isaac begins by saying, "Everything that is above another is concealed from what is beneath. This is not, however, because it possesses by nature a sort of veil composed of some other body. Therefore, when it wishes, it is able to uncover its hiddenness. No noetic essence acquires from outside of itself the distinction of its own rank, but these distinctions are confined within its motions. That is, to put the matter more plainly, it can, without mediation, enter into receive the primal light more easily than a lower order from which, evidently, it does not differ in locality, but according to the high degree and capacity of its purity, or according to the measure of the noetic beings therein as regards their capacity to receive signs and powers from above." So, angels can be very present to us, although hidden. And part of the hiddenness has to do with the purity that they have, that our incapacity to perceive them comes because of our sinfulness and our inability to perceive also the truth that they seek to reveal to us is a result of our sinfulness. And so as we grow in purity and we grow closer to them, not in terms of locality, but in terms of vision, that we're able to see with a greater clarity. And for me, this, as I went through, I had to read it dozens of times and read it in the context of the following homilies too, but it becomes thrilling as you go through it, because it begins to manifest to us that we aren't alone and isolated in the spiritual life, that God hasn't left us alone to engage in this struggle for purity of heart, or to come to understand the truth, or to enter into that deeper mystery of his life, that he's given us aids in this spiritual journey. And I think this is where we come back to this idea again of there being a kind of synergy that exists between creator and creature. And that certainly exists in a profound way between angels and God, but also between ourselves and the angels as well. The more we grow in purity of heart, the more that we are able to perceive them and also to receive the illumination that they are given and trusted to give to us. And so even though it sounds a little bit confusing now, I think hopefully as we go through it, it will become a little bit more exciting for us in terms of what he's saying. Every noetic essence is hidden from the essences that are below it, that they are not concealed from them by nature, but by the excellence of their motions. This I say concerning the orders of the holy powers, the orders of souls, and the orders of demons. The first are concealed from the second, and the second from the third by nature, place, and by respective movements. Each of the orders is separate, and moreover, with respect to knowledge, they are hidden from one another, whether they are seen or not. But they are hidden from those beneath them by nature. For the faculty of the sight of the bodiless is not from outside, as it is in the case of beings who possess bodies, but their ability to see one another is said to come from within their motions, by both the excellence and measure of their motions. For this reason, they are honored with an equal portion, then even though they be distant from one another, they see each other. Not in fantasy, but in real nature with an unerring sight. Howbeit, they see not the cause of all, who transcends this distinction, who alone is worshipful. And so we aren't equating them to God, but they share in an intimacy with God in such a way that then they can bear witness to it in a profound fashion. That if we were to perceive angels, they could manifest themselves to us in a kind of physical form, which he will go on to speak about later. But to truly see their essence only comes through a purified nous, the eye of the heart, the eye of the soul. And so as we engage in the ascetic life, the life of prayer, then this world opens up to us of greater and greater vision. And ultimately, this order will become non-existent in the kingdom. We will see God face to face. There won't be this need any longer for mediation. That there is no sin in God and nothing to impede our vision of him and of the truth. But while we are in this world, we have to engage in the ascetic life, the life of prayer, but also have the aid that aid of those God has given to us in order to perceive those greater truths. Okay, following me so far? Okay.
So he says that they are concealed, that each order is concealed from the ones below it, not by nature, but by the excellence of their motions. So does that mean that the greater the purity of heart of a human being, the more sort of protected it is from the demons, and that the angels themselves aren't necessarily visible to the demons?
Right. It's insofar as we would participate in the sinfulness,
right, that we would become visible to the demons.
Right, and more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But the more that we grow in purity of heart, the more visible angels become to us, but also demons become mm-hmm. visible to us and their actions. But that doesn't mean we are visible. What is within our heart is visible to them. And in one sense, we are in greater purity of heart, we would be of a higher order than the demons.
It's really interesting because I think, like, I mean, just from, like, this stupid, like, almost like cartoon idea we have of our guardian angel and our, you know, demon, our personal demon, you know, like, they are, like, equal and battling it out forever. But we're not abandoned to demons that are stronger and more powerful than our guardian angels. So, like, the guardian angels being above us and us hopefully being above the demons, and, you know, they're our guardian angels much stronger, actually.
Right, and I think this is why the fathers consistently tell us that, you know, if we're struggling in the spiritual life and it feels like we are on our back on the battlefield and the enemy is about to, you know, strike the death blow, that we shouldn't be fearful, that we should wage on in that battle, knowing that on the battlefield with us is Christ himself, but also the angels and the saints. And so there should never be a kind of fear within us in the spiritual battle. Any other thoughts before we move on a little further? Yes, Father Paul.
I just thought it was kind of interesting, like you had said, the language that St. Isaac uses, even though there's a practical purpose, he is using some, like, ontological language to describe this. And I recently read St. Gemma Galgani's diary, and she, her just writing down what she experienced without the understanding that St. Isaac has, kind of fleshes out exactly what he's talking about, even in a more speculative, like she would out of, like, forgetfulness or fear or laziness, in some way intentionally withhold something from her confessor, and her angel, she could see her guardian angel, and he would get upset and say, if you keep doing this, you're not going to see me anymore. And then she would go and confess that she had withheld that, and then he would be happy with her. So it was like her experience of her heart being purified, right, through sacramental grace and through conversion, enabled her to be able to see her guardian angel, and then he would warn her that if you keep sinning, you're not going to see him. So she was just writing down the stuff that Isaac is saying, right, in a more...
So it's not seeing with the physical eyes.
Right.
You know, it's seeing with the eye of the heart. It's a noetic vision rooted in the nous, the eye of the heart, the eye of the soul. And insofar as that's purified, then we have this vision of that which is of a higher order. And so, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that there would be consistency there, east or west, you know, in regards to the experience of this. One would hope that would be true, you know, that even though they live in a different time, you know, and the way that it would be articulated might be different, but there would be a consistency there of experience.
Would the sight of a noetic sight or spiritual sight of an angel be considered a consolation from God? Because I think I'm getting just slightly perplexed in that you become purified, you're able to communicate or to understand divine inspirations, but then it seems to contrast slightly with the idea of spiritual night, where you're kind of lost, you're moving forward in faith, but you may not see your path at all, you know, you're not receiving any consolations, you seem kind of, you know, especially some of the saints, you know, that, what was it, Mother Teresa had said, you know, she had, you know, felt like her whole life was a night. So, like, how does that go together?
Well, I think any time that we are perceiving on a level of faith and through the eyes of faith any greater truth about the spiritual life and about God, that we would attribute that to the guidance and the illumination that comes to us through the angels. That there is a kind of mediation that's given here. Their whole purpose is to communicate to a greater truth to us. And so whether that's perceived and received as a consolation or not is of no matter. what is of greater importance is the vision of the truth that lies before us and that we grasp through contemplation. That contemplation might be dark, you know, in the sense of walking in the darkness of faith, but it's still a knowing that we have at that time. And so, you know, because we don't, as we walk more and more in faith, the faculties that we have are quieted in order that we might be drawn on into the deeper reality of God himself and of God's life. And so, you know, our intellect and reason in and of themselves don't have the capacity to perceive that or any of our senses. And still, we are drawn along in the life of faith and instructed in those truths, come to perceive and understand them. And what Isaac is telling us is that the reason that we are understanding and seeing these things is because we are being instructed and guided by angels. That they have a distinct purpose and are in a distinct relationship with us. And I think that's what's so thrilling about it, is that, you know, they're not these abstract realities for us, and there's not this, you know, distant, you know, great distance, I think, that we often have in our mind between ourselves and angels. In fact, we're told that, you know, it's not a matter of physical existence. If our hearts are pure, we perceive not only the truth that they reveal to us, but perceive their presence. Yes?
And the demons are angels, or fallen angels. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But in that fallenness, then they lose that vision of higher. They lose that purity of vision and that the angels would have. And so, whereas the angels would be able to perceive us and what's going on within us because they have that purity, the demons can't. They can perceive patterns within us, negligence, laziness, you know, things that we give ourselves over to, and act on those in the form of temptation. But unlike angels, they, you know, cannot, you know, influence, have the same influence as angels would. But there's a limitation there, because of a limitation of vision. Okay. Where were we at? Leave off the demons? The demons, though they are extremely polluted, are not concealed from one another in their own orders, albeit they do not see the two orders that are above them. For spiritual sight is the light of motion, and these very motions are their mirror and their eyes. But when the motions are darkened, they cannot see the order above them. Now the demons, as being the most dense of the spiritual orders by comparison, can only see one another. So much for the demons. So, you know, he doesn't spend a lot of time there, because I think, you know, simply communicating to us their real limitations is all we really need to know. And in regards to, I think, what he's trying to instruct us about here now, that our focus should be on, you know, developing this noetic vision, you know, moving away from any kind of darkness within ourselves in order that we might experience greater and greater illumination. And, you know, for this, we don't want to make ourselves like the demons in the darkness of our sin, because that's where we become vulnerable. But if we are pure of heart, then there's a kind of invulnerability that we have there in terms of their influence. They cannot see what is within the heart. As for souls, to the degree that they are defiled and darkened, they are neither able to see one another nor themselves. But if they cleanse themselves and make their way back to their ancient created state, they will clearly see these three orders, that is, the order below them, the one above, and one another in their own order. But I do not mean to say that angels, demons, or other souls must be transformed into a bodily form so that pure souls can see them. On the contrary, they see into their very nature and their spiritual order. And so the greater purity we have, the greater our vision becomes of all orders, including of other souls. And so I think this is why we see in the saints a capacity to see what is going on within the other. You know, this ability that they often have to know the sins of others, or to see the demons that are attacking an individual. And, you know, because they share, you know, in this noetic vision that has not been clouded. But if you say that it is impossible for a demon or an angel to be seen if they are not altered and take on a physical form, then it is not the soul that sees, but the body. And if this be so, what need is there of purification? For behold how at times demons as well as angels appear even to the impure. Yet when they see with bodily eyes, and there is no need here of purification. It is not so, however, with the purified soul. For she sees in a spiritual manner with a natural eye, that is, a clairvoyant eye of insight. So an interesting way, I'd be curious what the actual word was there for clairvoyant, but this, you know, clairvoyant eye would be that which is able to see into the deeper realities. And so it's not with the physical eye, but rather again with the eye of the heart or the eye of the soul. Do not marvel that souls can see one another even while they are in the body. For I shall give you the most clear proof of this from one who bears witness to the truth. I mean the blessed Athanasius the Great in his life of the great Anthony. Once he says, while the great Anthony was standing at prayer, he saw someone's soul being raised aloft with much honor, and he called blessed the man who had been deemed worthy to receive such glory. This was the blessed Amon of Nitria. Now, the mountain where St. Anthony lived was 13 days' distance from Nitria. So, a simple example here, you know, just to show us that he's not speaking here of a bodily eye or the vision that comes through the senses, but rather through the soul itself that has been purified, or the heart that has been purified. This example has proved what was said concerning the three aforementioned orders, namely that even if spiritual natures are separated from one another, they see each other, and that distances and the bodily senses do not prevent them from seeing one another. So it is that purified souls do not see bodily, but spiritually. For bodily sight pertains to things that are evident, and it sees that which is before it. But things that are distant require another kind of vision. Any comments before we move on? Anybody struggling with what he's saying here?
I just don't see why can't we perceive demons if they're a lower order.
Well, I think he's saying that we can. That we can see both the higher order angels and the lower order demons, that given the fact that our heart would be purified, that vision would be given to us, that we would be able to see both, so angels and demons. It's the demons that cannot see. They would be the lower order because of the darkened nature of their vision.
Or why can't you see them if your heart's like not purified?
Well, he does say here that physically that there can be a manifestation where it doesn't depend upon purity of heart. But the vision that he's speaking of, and the more important one, is the one that does come through a kind of purity of heart, that is a vision that isn't bodily and that allows us to see the deeper truths and realities within others, ourselves, and angels. And so, you know, for a spiritual guide, we would want one who's living the spiritual life and seeking purity of heart. Because how would they guide us? Not just, you know, it's not simply through intellectual ability, their knowledge of the spiritual life. You would want one who has been purified in mind and heart in order that they might be able to, you know, give a kind of guidance that's rooted in something far beyond their own talents and abilities, but by virtue of what God has worked through them by His grace.
So basically, because it's not bodily vision, it's spiritual vision, our being able to perceive demons doesn't have to do with the fact that they're just lower because of the lower excellence of their emotions than us. It has to do, spiritual sight is always going to be dependent on the purity of the one whose sight it is, and thus, unless we're purified, we can't see the angels or the demons. It's not like, oh, I can't see angels, but I can see demons down there, because it's all spiritual sight, even if what you're seeing is something very ugly.
And I think this is why we begin to understand, too, why people would journey so far out to the desert to engage these elders, you know, those who had spent their life seeking purity of heart and embraced the ascetical life in such a radical way that they would become the most capable of spiritual guides. Okay. This example has proved what was said concerning the three aforementioned. Did I already read that?
Yeah.
Okay, where am I then? The highest orders. The highest orders are numberless according to their existence and are named corresponding to their distinction and order. For why else should they be called principalities, powers, authorities, and dominions, unless perhaps it is because they are specially honored? They are fewer in number than those who are in submission to them, as St. Dionysius, the Bishop of Athens, has said, while in power and knowledge they are great, and singular with respect to the magnitude of their own orders. They are arrayed from order to order until they reach the one order which is more ancient and mighty and glorious than all, which is the beginning and foundation of all created things. The beginning, I say, but not the creator of the primordial wonders of God's works. For there are many orders that are inferior with respect to their knowledge of the providence of the wisdom of God, their and our Creator, and they are as much inferior as the orders below them are in turn inferior to them. By inferior, I mean their exaltation or lowliness, not in a spatial sense, but as regards their power and knowledge in proportion to the measure which they have attained as a result of greater or lesser knowledge. And so, you know, by their ancient, within the order of creation itself, by their ancient existence, their intimacy with God, there might be fewer of them, but they have greater power and greater ability in the sense of their vision, and yet they are still as inferior to the Creator as the other orders are inferior to them. And so we don't want to make them equal to God, I think is what he's trying to make clear to here, that they are created as we are created, and so they stand as inferior to God in his holiness as the inferior orders, and we would stand in relationship to them. Where did I leave off? I'm sorry.
The divine books.
The divine books have given all these spiritual essences 9 spiritual names and divided them into 3 divisions of 3 each. The first is composed of the great, sublime, and most holy thrones, the many-eyed cherubim, and the 6-winged seraphim. The second in order is composed of the dominions, the authorities, and the powers. The third is composed of principalities, the archangels, and angels. The names of the orders are thus interpreted from the Hebrew tongue. The seraphim means those who are fervent and burning, the cherubim, those who are great in knowledge and wisdom, the thrones, receptacles of God, and rest. And so there are some that are filled with, as you look, see down in the footnote there, number 5, filled with light which is more sublime than all immaterial knowledge and are brimming as far as possible with the divine vision that is supra-essential and threefold beauty, who is the origin and maker of beauty. So the thrones upon whom God would rest, you know, obviously would have, they would be brimming over, as it were, or brimming, they would be full of this vision of the divine. These orders are given these names because of their operations. The thrones are so-called as being honorable, the dominions as those who possess authority over every kingdom, the principalities as those who govern the atmosphere, powers as those who have power over the nations and every man, authorities as those who are mighty in power and dreadful in appearance, the seraphim as those who make holy, the cherubim as those who carry, the archangels as vigilant guardians, and angels as those who are sent. And so, you know, he gradually leads us deeper and deeper, I think, into this mystery and the powers that are related to each of these orders and how we can understand, I think, their importance and certainly relevance within our spiritual lives. On the first day, 8 noetic natures were created, 7 in silence and 1 by a verbal command, and this was light. On the second day, the firmament was created. On the third day, God gathered the waters and made the herbs to sprout forth. On the fourth day, the division of light. On the fifth day, the birds, reptiles, and fishes. And on the sixth day, the animals and men and man. The frame of the whole world is length and breadth. The head is the east, the foot is the west, the right is the north, the left is the south. God laid out the entire earth as a bed, and the highest heaven as a vault. He fixed the second heaven as a wheel that adheres to the first heaven, and the borders of heaven and earth are joined to one another. He set the ocean as a girdle that encompasses heaven and earth. Therein he established lofty mountains reaching even to the heaven. And he ordered the sun to journey behind the mountains all the night long. He set the great sea within the mountains, and it dominates over 1/2 and 1/4 of the dry land. To our God be glory. And so, you know, we're being presented here with Isaac's, you know, sort of cosmology, his understanding of creation itself, from the angels through man and then the earth and heavens and the earth. But the main point, I think, that we are to gain from this is, again, the significance and the importance of the angels for our spiritual life. And as I said, this is going to be fleshed out in homily 27 and then 28 especially. Any comments about this particular homily before we move on? So a little bit more challenging, I think, because of the distinctions that he's making, but don't lose heart in the homilies to come. Things become clear. Any comment before we move on to the next? Okay. Homily 27. Against those who say, if God is good, why has he made these things? Sin, Gehenna, and death do not exist at all with God, for they are effects, not substances. Sin is the fruit of the will. There was a time when sin did not exist, and there will be a time when it will not exist. Gehenna is the fruit of sin. At some point in time, it received a beginning, but its end is not known. Death, however, is a dispensation of the wisdom of the Creator. It will have power over nature only for a time. Then it will be totally abolished. Satan is the name of the wills turning aside from the truth and not the designation of a nature. Although, yeah, in the footnote, if you'll notice, number two, that they make it clear that in this he's not denying the presence of the existence of Satan, who is the personal existence of Satan, but rather is making this distinction, I think, for an important reason. You know, the will's turning aside from the truth. Insofar as we turn away from the truth, we become sons and daughters of Satan. Or we become Satan ourselves. And whenever our will turns away from God, we cease to participate in that life.
Which is interesting, because it sounds really harsh, like, oh, we become Satan. But, like, if you think about what it took for Jesus to call St. Peter Satan, it was nothing more than him trying to deny the necessity of this suffering and death that had been said over and over again. And that's all it took for him to be called Satan. So, you know, it doesn't take all that much for us to get there.
Yeah, much less, probably. Even if you should find some of these things written in other places, oh my brother, may we not be reckoned in your eyes as ostentatious men, who display ourselves with the works of others, but on the contrary as humble men who suck the milk of our fathers who have gone before us. I mean those things which we have gathered and placed before ourselves as objects of theoria, with the aim of enriching our understanding with these provisions, whereon we can graze and be sustained. For we have not forgotten that we do not rise above the rank of learners so long as we dwell in the flesh. And so, you know, we're not engaged in the reading of the fathers and the reading of Isaac with, you know, in a kind of dilettantism, you know, where we are immersing ourselves in the study of the fathers in order that we can talk about what they've taught. We study their writings in order that we might embrace their teachings. With this realization, we also understand that we are all learners. So long as we are on this earth, we're not masters of these truths. We're students, we're disciples, and always being nourished and sustained by the writings of those and the lives of those who have gone before us. Discernment consists in the direction a man's natural thoughts take. For when the thoughts by their motions proceed on nature's path, they encounter the changing elements and the ages of the world. But when they proceed on a second way, there will be for them another employment than that which they had. For when the natural thoughts and the intelligence are twofold in their employment, they will be recognized in one of these only, that is, in the order which does not pertain to the soul. And so, you know, there is a kind of discernment where we can be limited. We only see and perceive that which we can see through the senses. It's corporeal knowledge. We can discern certain truths of the world. And I think this is why, you know, the more and more that the culture has moved away from the faith from belief in God, the more exalted it has become in its own, you know, pride. You know, it's thinking that, you know, our growth as human beings comes simply through our growth in knowledge and our capacity, our power to produce things within this world, not realizing that, you know, that discernment is very limited and painfully limited. As well, we perceive very little of the truth if we only perceive the external truths around us that we can perceive through our senses and then examine through the powers of our intellect and reason. We might be the most brilliant individual upon this earth and still be blind to the greater measure of truth.
Yeah,
I leave off. I'm sorry, I keep losing my place. When you encounter sweetness in the verses of your liturgy, your mind greedily desires to enjoy that sweetness continually. And if you wish to grant its request, quickly strive to know the cause of such delight. If you reach it swiftly, as a discerning and not a blind man, it will not be difficult for you to enjoy it always without hindrance. And what, then, is the active agent which is also called cause? A file, without adding anything to iron, makes it bright and radiant, for such is the essence of iron. How? It removes the rust which has come upon it when it is unused. The same holds true for theoria in relation to the nature of the mind. Bring your mind to the file, and you will find how it shines clearly during your liturgy, emulating the brilliance of the stars. For the mind is unable to proceed onward without this action, and it lingers when unattended. And so our entrance into the holy mysteries is a purifying reality for us. And so if we experience sweetness in the liturgy, and we set our minds to looking to the cause of that, the cause of that is that the liturgy itself is purifying. And in the purifying of the heart, we begin to experience the sweetness of it. And so for us, you know, worship, the praise of God is always going to be the essential way that we grow in holiness and grow in purity of heart. And so participation in the divine liturgy, Mass, the liturgy of the hours, the prayer of the church, the psalmody, our private prayer, other ascetical practices, it's all through these ways that we are purified. These are the causes of our purification. But the most powerful for us would be the divine liturgy itself. It is the ordinary means through which we are cleansed of our sin. And in the cleansing of our sin, we come to a deeper vision of God. We see the truth and the beauty. And if that's stirred in us, we now know why. It's because we are participating in that which is holy and cleansing for us. And so, again, this is why we wouldn't want to enter into liturgy in an unprepared fashion or not discerning what it is that we are engaging in. And so how to prepare ourselves, how to enter into it, and then to perpetuate that reality, then through the divine office, the liturgy of the hours, and then through the rest of our prayer life. So we move from Eucharist to Eucharist, and, you know, we are to shine then more and more brilliantly through this reality. This should be the focus of our life, and anything that impedes that, we would want to rid ourselves of. Anything that keeps us from experiencing this purifying process. Where did I leave off?
For the mind.
I'm sorry.
Right after the stars.
Hold on for a second. I'm going blind.
Right in the middle of the page.
Right in the middle of the page.
For the
mind is, okay, I see it. For the mind is unable to proceed onward without this action, and it lingers when unattended. For this reason, I said that during psalmody, but not during the prayer of the heart and reading, the mind can be held fast only with difficulty. But this is not the case with prayer and reading, and with them only small care is needed. Furthermore, their assistance during psalmody is necessary. Indeed, without them, diligence in psalmody will be found to be in vain. And they again, at the very time when nourishment is furnished, give support to psalmody, and not from any other quarter than from these provisions. For hunger knows how to procure food, but it will not be persuaded to refrain from eating it. So you know, we have to again and again bring our mind to the foul, you know, to that which is going to bring purification to us. And there are ways in which this is easier for us to do and others where it's harder to maintain that level of concentration. Sweet to the laborer is bread earned by its own sweat. Until a man has sweated, the bread of truth will not satisfy him. The body, which is the laborer, sweats and it nourishes the rational mind. And this occurs when the mind is deprived of its customary unnatural nourishment. So it's interesting that there is a kind of spiritual labor that we engage in, humbling of the mind and the body. And when we experience this, it satisfies us with an even greater measure. You know, if we are participating in a passive fashion, it's not going to have the same effect upon us. That to be fully engaged in that worship of God, you know, as opposed to sitting in a pew, you know, gazing off into nowhere, you know, but those two realities are going to have a much different effect. If we are fully involved in what's taking place at the altar and engaged in the prayers that are being sung or said, you know, that's where the greater transformation, but also the greater joy is going to come from. That we might be exhausted after that reality, but far more satisfied because of the intimacy that has come and the purification that has come through it. Spiritual virtue is the daughter of the will's virtue, and necessarily so. Therefore, free will, not bondage, is the natural power of reason. But when it turns to one side or the other and stays there, then it engenders another power which is not of nature. When this was engendered, free will came to be governed by and subject to compulsion, and I will may confidently call it bound and without dominion over itself. Before this, compulsion was a matter of the will, but now compulsion has the will in subjection. This, I say, can be seen on both sides, whether a man enslaves himself to the right or gives way to the left. But the mind that knows how to see keenly is able to perceive in every instance how compulsion subdues free will when this power not found in nature is born of voluntary subjugation. I do not mean here the power that is born of habit, which is very difficult to withstand, but that which is called the vindicator. At any rate, habit is subject to the will, although it is a laborious thing to resist habit. Apart from this, we know of two powers. One enslaves the will, but the other prevails upon nature itself and even has authority to alter nature. This power, which is an energy, that is grace, that overrides nature, is known to those who have experienced it. So, you know, in our sinfulness, we begin, our will begins to be subjugated to compulsion, you know, that we are driven by our desire for sin, and that this is only with great difficulty changed in direction, that once a habit has taken form, then the will has lost power and is driven, we're simply driven by that compulsion for what the senses desire. But it's when we are given over to grace, then the will becomes something that is transformed, that leads us to pursue with greater and greater desire that which is holy and good. Yes?
At the very bottom of page 258,
mm-hmm.
What is the customary unnatural nourishment of the mind that it is deprived of in spiritual labor?
Let me think here for a second. The body, which is the laborer, sweats and it nourishes the rational mind. And this occurs when the mind is deprived of its customary unnatural nourishment. And so, you know, when not otherwise not occupied with the worship of God, when we are not directed in every way through the labor, spiritual labor, in terms of directing the mind and the heart to God, then we're going to be directed to what is perceived in and through the senses and be drawn in whatever way that would take us. Especially when it's, you know, driven by sin, or when the will has been weakened by sin. The different states of men's hearts and the dissimilar ways of thinking that are usually born of them, whether free or not free, engendering life or death, are greatly assisted by the ununiformity, or rather the unevenness of the theoria that arises in men's minds concerning God's judgments. The world has been kept for thousands of years in this ununiformity, which is placed in the midst of things. This ununiformity greatly assists the variableness of the courses found on the path of mortal life, and what is greater still, it leads men to theoria concerning the divine judgments that engender conceptions about God. It is the case with many hearts that as soon as confidence has entered within them, they become like a man that has taken deadly poison. For even with true and genuine sons, 10 parts of love should be mixed with 5 parts of fear. Nature that is subject to aberration is not sufficient to receive here the perfection of divine truth, or to know completely the will that God has for his rational beings. Even men such as Paul and his like are insufficient for this until the time come that aberration should be taken away, so that nature should no longer go astray through the influence it feels from aberration. So there, you know, is kind of unevenness within us, an unsteadiness. We are inconstant in mind and desire, and so can be led in every different kind of direction. And it's only, you know, through the spiritual disciplines that, you know, we move away from this aberration or this inconstancy that we find within ourselves. And, you know, even the saints, as you said, or Paul, you know, they knew a kind of inconstancy, even within the desire within themselves, even though they know what they should love, and they love that which is greater, they still do the very thing that they hate. There's such an inconstancy that we struggle with, that we'll often move away from God, even in a way that seems to be against our will. And so we have to, you know, wait for this tendency to go astray to be taken away from us by the grace of God and through the spiritual life and the discipline that he puts before us. So there's a little more here that he'll develop, but this brings us to 8:30. And are there any questions or comments on the homilies that we've been looking at?
Are Paul and his like the oratorians?
Huh?
Is that right?
Are you saying Paul, that we're inconstant? Uneven? Ununiformity?
Paul and his like.
Any thoughts?
I'm still confused.
Okay, that's okay. I mean, I think once we make it through this homily and into the next, it does become a little bit clearer.
I feel like there are a lot of like thoughts that he like randomly mentions, but then he doesn't talk about them.
Right.
Like the Vindicator.
That's right.
It's like he just says it, and it's like, what is it?
Yeah. I think the Vindicator would be the spirit of truth.
Okay.
You know, that judges, you know, that would but it's a homily 28 that I found, and things begin to, it begins to pull things back together. Angels come back into the picture, and there's, he brings, the picture becomes clearer for us. So don't, I know this was sort of a labor tonight, but I think there's greater clarity to come in the weeks to come. Okay? All right, well, we close as always with the prayer of service. Give us the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.